Monster Man, special episode, The Monsters of Winter.
Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games.
Today's episode is a seasonal episode, by which I mean a special episode brought to you by the generosity and public spirit of my Patreon backers, and in particular, of Patreon backer Edwin. If you'd like to be like Edwin and get your own special episode, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. And if you do that, you'll also get the rewards for other levels, including, at the $2 level, my other podcast, Patron Deities, in which I talk about the Deities and Demigods supplement for AD&D 1st Edition, and the job it does of translating real-world religion and mythology into fantasy RPGs. The job is mixed, in case you're wondering. Mixed. Anyway, Edwin, thank you very much for your support, and I hope that you enjoyed today's episode. Edwin has asked me to talk about seasonal monsters, specifically the monsters of winter, the season in which we find ourselves at the minute. Now, if you're listening to this later on, it's the middle of December 2021 as I'm recording this. Seasonality in games is an interesting thing, isn't it? You know, seasons play such an important role in our lives in the real world. They determine what kind of clothes we wear, what kind of foods we eat, what kind of holidays we celebrate. I mean, everything. And that was even more the case for people who lived in the ancient and medieval societies that often inspire fantasy societies. But it's not really all that common in role-playing games to find seasonal elements in a scenario, seasonal festivities. I mean, not saying there are none, there definitely are. But I think that it's not as common as it might be, because this would make like a published scenario hard to integrate into an existing campaign, right? If it has to be a certain time of year for your adventure to work, then probably it's going to have less utility to a GM than an adventure that can be set anytime. But it's kind of a shame, because I feel like people sort of imagine a generic summer sort of all the time. It's very seldom raining in RPGs. Mind you, that's not universally true, and I think there are settings where it's common. So, for instance, the kind of long time scale of a Pendragon campaign means that seasonality is very important, right? The seasons are mechanically different in Pendragon. You know, you do different things in the different phases. In HeroQuest, and I assume also in RuneQuest, it's important too, as your community cycles through different seasonal festivities. And of course, a sacred time is this, you know, particular period of the year where magical things happen. In fact, the campaign that I am playing in is divided into seasonal, well, seasons, right? So the sort of, on the one hand, they're almost like seasons of a TV show, but on the other hand, they're like seasons in the sense of seasons of the year. We're currently in autumn, and each of them has had kind of different thematic elements that relate to the idea of it being that particular season. The only aspect of seasonality that really appears in my games is the holiday special. Most of my games have holiday specials. I suppose the holiday special, which is also the finale for my Other Dust game, is coming up this week. Indeed, it'll have happened by the time you listen to this episode. But yeah, every year there's a holiday special, and it usually has some kind of, you know, seasonal monster to it. In my old D&D game, that meant, you know, fighting animated snow constructs, or snowlums, as they as the players dubbed them. It could mean fighting Christmas tree ants that threw exploding baubles. It could mean fighting the villainous wizard Gyrinx, who was essentially the Grinch. There was a session of the Other Dust game where the characters had to change the mind of a hard-hearted employer, and so on. Just kind of a recurring bit that most of my games have holiday specials. But I wouldn't say that creatures like the snowlums or the Christmas tree ant or anything like that are particularly seasonal monsters, other than like in the form of goofs. And actually, we will return to the seasonal goof later on, because actually I think it has an important role to play in the way that the season is commemorated. But for now, let's take our seasonal monsters a little bit more seriously and take a look at what kind of monsters not just would appear in winter, but are particularly wintry. You know, what are the themes that we would expect these creatures to reflect? So when we think about seasons, we're thinking about how humans experience the passage of time, which means that we are talking not just about the natural world, but about the social world. We're talking about human perceptions and human understandings and human experiences of the natural world. So to begin with the natural world, obviously winter is cold and it's dark. So monsters that fit that cold and dark, that hate the light or that hate heat, monsters that survive well in cold climates. And in particular, there's a certain horror of something that is moving and happy in an environment that, to you, the human viewer, seems inimical. The outside is a dark, dangerous, forbidding place. You know, a lot of your things that you can do to protect yourself don't work as well in the wintertime. If there's a lot of snow on the ground, it's harder to run. It's dark, so it's harder to see things. The weather is bad, so it's harder to like move to a different place. We also tend to associate this season with death. You know, fields are empty of their crops, waiting to be planted again in spring. You know, they've been harvested. Trees are often bare of their leaves. Animals might be hibernating. The world seems like a quieter and more desolate place. And there's something about that that we relate to our own ideas of death. The idea of winter as symbolic of death, something that we often see, or being dead, right? In myths where you have an autumnal experience of death, a wintry experience of being dead, and a spring-like experience of being reborn. This is a pretty common image in a lot of art. But the idea of winter as a time of fruitless trees, hibernating animals, you know, maybe migrating animals that go south for the winter or whatever, that connects to some of our social understandings of winter. So, for example, socially, winter can be understood as a time of shortage. Now, ironically, I don't know that winter, like, if you look at kind of an early medieval or medieval society, which is the kind of society that I used to study, I don't know that winter necessarily is this time of terrible shortage, because autumn is the time that you bring your harvest in. So actually, you know, insofar as your reserves are ever really good, they might be at their best going into winter. You've just slaughtered your animals, right? So a lot of people who raised animals would do a big slaughter in autumn, because that would be a time when, you know, they didn't want the expense of feeding animals over the winter, so they would keep their breeding stock, but then they would slaughter the rest, and so they'd have a lot of, like, preserved meat going into the winter. Having said that, okay, the barns are full, we have all this, but if there is a shortage, then we don't really have a good way of getting more. And there are certain things that we're going to have a hard time preserving, right? Because we're not going to have a lot, for example, of fresh vegetables and fruit. So even if we have a lot of food, we may be affected by certain types of shortages. And that, of course, all assumes that the harvest and the slaughter went well, which we don't know until they're over. And if they didn't go well, then winter could be pretty tough. So we're pretty sure that we have enough to get through the winter, but we can never be completely sure. So even if it's not a time of dearth, it's a time of anxiety about it. Another aspect of the social understanding of winter is the idea of isolation. You know, if we're talking about, you know, a society that has kind of pre-modern transport capacities, then we might see a place that, you know, winter really cuts down on travel, whether that's rivers being frozen or roads being covered in snow. Like, it's not like there's people out there plowing the streets, or just the weather being really bad. And it's not like you get into a nice warm car and ride for a long way. So people in general do their business or religious or whatever traveling in, you know, the spring and the summer. And you only really travel in winter if, you know, that you have to. Obviously, that depends on the local climate, that depends on the journey. But on average, I'd say in most pre-modern settlements, you're going to see a lot less travel during the winter months. It's just more difficult. And you know, the weather could be worse at sea, for example, so you might also have that problem. Days are short, so safe travel is harder. Under bad circumstances, you could even get snowed in. So what that means is you're kind of stuck with the people you already know, and they are stuck with you. Because I think that the horror of isolation is twofold, right? First, there's the idea that we, the community, are within this little firelit circle, and outside in the dark are all the scary things of the night and the wilderness. That's a very common understanding of what a monster is, and I think it's a very wintry understanding, because in the winter, that firelit circle shrinks. And we feel like that anyway, even though for us it isn't really true, right? You could book a plane ticket and go to Aruba for Christmas. I mean, maybe not this Christmas, and it's not what I would do, but you know what I mean. Our transportation options, our socialization options, my parents live 6,000 miles away, and I'm going to talk to them on Christmas Day. So I'm not as isolated as someone from one of those societies, but I still kind of feel that way. You know, I still kind of feel like I'm going to lay in supplies. You know, I'm going to put a stack of books to read. I'm going to like only emerge to walk my dog. And I'm just going to, you know, for a couple weeks of winter, I'm just going to sit at home in the warm in my T-Rex in a Santa hat slipper sock thingies. And, you know, I'm going to hunker down against the dark outside, even though actually I don't have to do any of that if I don't want to. Even though my like laying in supplies for the dark only means going to Aldi. But complementary to that, there is the horror of community. Because it's not only that the community is hunkered down in defense against the cold and the dark outside, but also that now I'm stuck with these people, right? And this extends into the modern day, where winter is often a time of homecoming, whether we're talking about, you know, traditional journeys to visit family for holidays like Christmas, or, you know, university students coming home for the winter break. And not all of these homecomings are joyful. You know, they could be actually first-time homecomings. So, for example, the first time you go to visit your partner's family for the holidays can be a very awkward time, although it's unlikely to be the first time you're seeing them. That's more something that happens in movies than real life, right? But it's not impossible. And again, in this kind of fantasy society, it could very well be possible. You know, your daughter moved to the big city to study at wizard school, and now she's like met and married a fellow student, and now they're coming home for their first midwinter feast, and you know, you're kind of curious. You know, you've read about this person in letters, but what are they really like? And there are a lot of people who have things about the places that they go back to at times of homecoming that they would rather not return to. People at home that you don't want to see. We don't always want to go back, at least not wholeheartedly, but we kind of have to. So there are monstrous or horrific aspects to not just the world outside that forces you into confinement with other people, but to the other people with whom you are confined. In monster terms, I think this translates into, well, let's take a look at kind of 3 to 4, depending on how you count, types of winter monster. First up, you have the winter monster par excellence, the wolf. The wolf is the monster outside. It doesn't hibernate, and winter has come, and that means that there is less game for it to hunt, and there are fewer people about to deter it. So it is coming closer and closer to the firelit circle, coming closer and closer to your home. And if it gets really hungry, it might do something out of character. But we understand the wolf as a creature that you can keep from the door, right? Hence the expression. But winter is the worst time for that. And it does that thing that I mentioned earlier. It seems at home in a landscape that is hostile to you. If I had to run away from a wolf, I mean, there's no time that I could run away from a wolf and it wouldn't catch me. But winter would be the worst time, as I floundered through the snow and I'm wearing, you know, a scarf and a coat and gloves, and I'm like fumbling and sweating, and that wolf is going to be on me. While you and your dog are huddled by the fire, the wolf is prowling around the winter woods and doesn't seem that bothered. So it makes you feel vulnerable, even though you are protected. Now, in contrast to the monster outside, let's think about the monster inside. So I think that the wintry monster inside could be something like a doppelganger, could be something like a vampire. That idea of being stuck in a particular location with a group of people, well, one of those people could be a monster, and would there necessarily be anything you can do about it? I've been kind of envisioning this sort of bucolic, you know, penned up against the howling gale in some kind of a thatch-roofed cottage with a hearth. But, you know, if you were staying the winter in some kind of gothic castle, you know, you're looking outside the window and the moon is shining coldly down on the snow covering the gardens, and you know that it's miles to anywhere. You know, there's a little village where people are huddling in their thatch roof cottages maybe, but to really get to safety inside, the guests are exchanging suspicious glances and cryptic remarks in the candlelit dining room, and it just seems normal the first time someone turns up dead. And it gives us that classic mystery scenario setup, right? Because we are all confined in here, we know that no one has left or entered. And that means, as player characters love to say when they realize it, that the killer must still be in the house. So the monster inside plays on our fears of being trapped with people we can't stand or trapped with strangers. A few weeks ago in the UK, we were hit by this storm, Storm Irwin. And there was a group of people who were in this pub way out in the countryside. So I forget exactly where it is. It has, supposedly, it's Britain's like highest elevation pub. So it's this remote pub that is kind of like a little tourist destination, I guess. They had a couple dozen people there who had gone to see, I think, an Oasis tribute band. And the roads were closed because of the snow. And there were, whatever, 40 to 60 people all stuck up there for days until the roads could be reopened and they were able to return safely. And for a couple of days, being stuck in a pub with a bunch of other people is sort of funny. They had a pub quiz and they had a karaoke night and they played board games and they just tried to pass the time, you know? They had phone signal and so on. But even with all those things, get past about 3 days, and I at least would start to fray. I would start to fray before 3 days, let's be honest. But past those 3 days, I'd be surprised every time a body didn't turn up. Now, both the vampire, at least, and the wolf are monsters about hunger, and that's a state that we associate with winter. And so the same goes for the next monster on my list, which is the Wendigo. Now, the Wendigo, of course, is this cannibal spirit. I don't think of it as a seasonal monster because it's a creature of cold places, not a creature of cold times. Now, that's probably not true. And things like the film Ravenous or other, you know, Wendigo-related stories like that, you know, they connect to the idea of winter as a time of isolation. But to my mind, probably the most famous English language story about the Wendigo, which is, of course, Algernon Blackwood's The Wendigo, is mainly about the destructive allure of dangerous places rather than the conditions of a time. So maybe that's splitting hairs. I don't know if the Wendigo is a winter monster, but it's a good, you know, it combines that element of what's going on in the minds of the other people who are trapped here with you. And there are dangers in the woods around us, dangers in the snow. On the other hand, there is a Christmas monster tradition that I haven't really talked about, and that is, of course, the tradition of the cozy monster, where the monster is there to reinforce the sense of, like, specialness and holidayness of this time of year. Did I just say Christmas monster instead of winter monster? I actually don't know if there are monster traditions associated with other winter festivals. But if you're from a community that celebrates a different winter festival, does your winter festival have monsters? I'm interested to know. But ghost stories have a long Christmas tradition, right? There'll be scary ghost stories and tales of the glories of Christmas long, long ago. And I don't know why ghost stories are associated with Christmas, other than that it's wintertime and it's dark and you're probably spending a lot of time sitting by the fire. And that's a naturally spooky environment for telling ghost stories in. It's not something that ever my family did when I was a kid, but it is an old and venerable tradition. And of course, from that tradition of Christmas ghost stories, we get things like A Christmas Carol, where a ghost story is understood to be a natural thing to have at Christmas time. Maybe it's also because the end of the year is a natural time to think about, you know, marking the passage of time and thinking about the passage of time means thinking about people who've been lost. But I don't get that quality from Christmas ghost stories generally, right? They tend to be spooky chillers rather than like real serious meditations about death or kind of parable-like stories like A Christmas Carol. So I think there is room for that cozy monster, whether that's the ghost story, which is fun and spooky, like it's fun to pretend to believe in ghosts for a little bit, but we actually don't. Or if we do, we probably don't believe in the kind of ghosts that are in these ghost stories, right? And then, of course, you have the various traditional Christmas monsters, like the Kalakensaroi in Greece, or the Yule lads in Iceland, or the Yule cat, that's in Iceland as well, I guess. And they all have kind of, like the Kalakensaroi, I'm probably mispronouncing that, I don't speak Greek, they are little monsters that live underground, and they saw down the world tree most of the year. But when Christmas comes, they come up to the upper world for the 12 days of Christmas, and they leave their job unfinished, and then the year ends without the tree being sawn down, and they have to start over. And they are mischievous little guys who, like, are like not so much dangerous as kind of annoying, but there are things you can do to protect yourself, like putting certain symbols up or leaving them offerings of food. I mean, they're kind of mischievous sprites, but they are specifically Christmas mischievous sprites, and their presence, there's nothing Christmassy about them specifically, other than that their presence marks out a particular time of the year as supernaturally interesting. Or, you know, the Krampus, right, that punishes naughty children. And all of these kind of monsters that enter into a spirit of sort of licensed misrule, which is something that is often associated with winter socially as well, right? With the end of the year, with the particular sacred times, the idea that particular times are tied to other times, like, you know, when it's Easter, it's always Easter sort of moments. I don't know that that's something I can necessarily explain very clearly, but there's a universality to those moments in time, and the presence of things that would otherwise be outside the laws of nature relates to the ways in which those are times for behaviors that are also otherwise outside the rules of society. So if you have like boy bishops or servants dressing in their master's clothes or whatever, those are violations of the social order in the same way that the presence of like a mischievous Yule lad could be seen as a violation of the natural order. And I think they go together in kind of the popular conception of the two. Does that make sense? I don't know that winter is necessarily the time of misrule, particularly if your year doesn't end in the winter. So, I mean, I don't know. Do Australians still have the same kind of like misrule things, even though for them, Christmas and the end of the year take place in summer? I don't know. So those, I think, are the types of monsters that you can use in a wintry scenario, right? They're monsters that tie into the feelings that we feel in winter. The fear of the dark outside, you know, that's the wolf, but it's also the Yeti, for example, or, you know, there are even like the Barghest, right? There are lots of monsters that have that sort of the dark outside, the cold outside feeling about them. The fear of, you know, the person you're stuck inside with. Gee, The Thing is really a wintry movie, even though it's not cold because it's winter, it's cold because of the like where they are. The tradition of a type of monster that is associated with that time of year, even if there's nothing, I don't think there's anything inherently wintry in the Yuletide monsters of various kinds, except that now we think there is. And of course, I haven't talked about like personifications of weather, you know, Jack Frost and so on, but you could definitely include them in that list as well. So those are some of my thoughts on the monsters of winter. And I'm interested in hearing if, you know, you have monsters that you associate with particular seasons. Are there summer monsters, autumnal monsters, other than the scarecrow, etc.? I don't know. It's something that doesn't come up as much in games as maybe it should. So anyway, Edwin, thank you once again for your support, and I hope that you enjoyed the episode. Everyone else, if you'd like to be like Edwin and get your own special episode, remember that all you have to do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. In our next episode, it will be our 400th regular episode, not counting specials, not counting patron deities, so in reality, well over our 500th, as we take a look at yet more monsters from Monsters Manual. And then, at the end of the week, we're going to wrap it up for this year with another special episode. So I hope that you will join me then for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening.
If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.